can go into these nibbles at any stage, yeah?
Dive in, mate, dive in, yeah. Healthy nibbles just for you. I've smashed most of the jelly beans already, anyway. Leah was like, they're for the guests. I know, I'm really hungry. Can we crack on?
Yeah, it won't be.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Are you ready? Welcome to After the Whistle with me, Lewis Moody.
And me, Leon Lloyd.
And I am delighted to say that we've got a wonderful guest with us today, Mr. Wayne Hoyle, also known as Rosie, I believe, because of the colour of his hair once. Is that right?
You know exactly why I'm called Rosie, but you want me to just explain the story in this particular
environment, don't you? Well, it's gone lovely and grey now, hasn't it?
So it's just to try and make me more uncomfortable surrounded by former professional athletes like yourself.
Oh, mate, you're an athlete in your own right. But let's introduce you properly. So Wayne joined the Marines in 1985. He had an impressive and remarkable career for 30 years with the SBS. He's a former captain, retiring in 2017. He was involved in every major conflict since the 1980s, which gives us some idea of how old he is.
And there was only a few.
He's held a range of key appointments in combat and HQ levels, including 2 years command assignment to US SEAL Team 6, worked alongside the government agencies to help combat the terrorist threat, has been responsible for recruiting and training of the new Special Forces soldiers, and he now supports numerous charities, including my own, of course, including the Lewis Moody Foundation, helping to raise millions in the process, putting on challenges around the world. And we first went off to the North Pole together, didn't we? Which was quite nice.
That was the first charity event, yeah. Not the first time we met. But we'll probably go on to that in a moment. But it's the first time we raised any money, yeah.
And Leon was ribbing me earlier because I did have to pull out of an event before the North Pole with a friend of ours, Alan Chambers, because I got frostbite. And actually, I know you were ribbing me, but because I got frostbite on that, it meant that I'd learnt a bit when we got to the North Pole, and I essentially had to spend the majority of the time whenever we stopped. So we'd have like a 2 hour stretch walking, wouldn't we? And then we'd have 5-10 minute break. It was supposed to be 5-10 minutes. But because of my bad circulation, I'd spend about 10 minutes or 7 of those 10 minutes just swinging my arms, trying to keep them warm. So I didn't get frostbite again. So there you go.
It wasn't a wasted trip this time.
He spent half of his career swinging his arms from what I was
trying to catch the ball. But anyway, we're not here to talk about me, mate. I mean, you've had an incredible career, but 30 years in the Special Forces, an enormous amount of time. And as former athletes that were indoctrinated into a world of elite sport, it must be really hard when you step out of that environment. What's it like stepping into normality now, being a normal person? How's that been?
Well, firstly, is it actually possible to step into normal life after you've been through that?
The first question is, what do we call normal, really? You know, do we have to live our lives in a certain way, or can we not have as much variation and diversity as possible? I think that for me personally, I was very, very fortunate that, you know, the organisation I was leaving still valued some contribution I could make to it. And so I was retained in a certain form, if you like, so that I could work on projects with them whilst transitioning into a different career, if you like. So it wasn't there was no immediate severance, and I left that behind. I was able to wean myself away from it slowly but surely, if you like, really.
So I suppose that's similar. Well, it can be likened to a retirement when you retire, and that's more formal and a sort of an abrupt end, to transitioning where you're just moving from one career into a different career, which if you could do it over phases, it's slightly easier.
Absolutely. I think that I've been able to employ the same sort of traits, skills, principles, values, all behaviours, all those things that I employed when I was working for that organisation. So whether it be the physical elements or the mental elements, or, you know, the social support elements, being a part of a team, part of a tribe, I've been able to maintain that moving from the military into a civilian world, you know, whether it's helping other people to improve how they work as a team, or being a part of a team on a charity fundraising event. So really, you could say, apart from my adversary, things haven't particularly changed, really.
I was going to say, so it's been really interesting. You spoke about the trips that we've done and the challenges. We've been to North Pole. We've done 1,000 miles across Vietnam and Cambodia. Costa Rica, we crossed Costa Rica. Now, when I say we've done it, you've put in all the planning and the logistics. You know, I was merely the beautiful face that sort of gathered everyone together. But it's been really interesting, because you say, you know, it's just carried on as normal. But I know from seeing you on those trips, when you as a special forces officer, operator, you know, whatever part you were playing in your career, you expect certain standards and you expect certain behaviors. And I remember you standing up in a meeting one day. It was a briefing talking about the next day and the kit and everything like that. And you were saying, right, guys, you know, this is what we need to wear tomorrow. We've got to bring our bike kit because we're going to be on the bikes first and then we're going to transition into the canoe. So make sure you've got, you know, your canoe gear. And I'm going to bring some little wet boot thingies, waterproof boots, wetsuit booties, that was it. And at the end of it, it'd obviously be a long couple of days anyway. And everyone was pretty knackered. It was the end of a long day. You get up, tell everyone what they need, sit down. And I always get the impression that when you stand up and deliver that, in your world, in your former role, there wouldn't have been the need for questions because you would have delivered it and everyone would have been, right, got it, yeah, yeah. So when you ask for questions at the end, and I think in your head actually thinking, no, it's pretty clear, I've told them what they need to know, there obviously won't be any. And the first question that comes back is, well, when you said we need waterproof booties, do we really need waterproof booties? And your face dropped, it was like that. It was literally like someone had kicked you straight in the balls. It was like, what? I really want to know, how's that like interaction with people? Because I say normal, and you're right, you know, maybe normal is the wrong word, but interacting with people that aren't used to just saying, right, because you've told me to do it, doesn't mean I'm necessarily just going to go along with it. How's that sort of people relationship been for you? How have you found that? It must be challenging.
Well, yeah, it is challenging, but I mean, going back to that particular... Well, I've made that mistake on a number of occasions when I was in the military or since, is perhaps not briefing particularly well. Somebody said that, you know, if you can't explain it to a four-year-old, your knowledge is not particularly good of it anyway, really. So I probably just didn't explain the detail particularly well on that occasion. But you're absolutely right. It is difficult transitioning from the military into a civilian world and using the right terminology, the right language, the right intonation is particularly important because... Can you stand over there and do that? Is particularly aggressive, or, you know, please stand over there and do that. It's obviously much, much more workable now. I'm not saying that you should be particularly aggressive in a military world, but you would expect people to be paying particular attention because, you know, come the day of the race, when you're at the sharp end, then it could probably go wrong if you haven't picked up that detail. And you might not be able to say it again. You might not be able to repeat yourself. I used to use this saying quite a lot when we first used to deploy onto operations. For the first three tasks, I would always say to the lads, before you press the pressel switch.
What's the pressel switch?
The pressel switch on a radio, beg your pardon, we'll be able to
call
and
paste. We'll be able to call and paste there.
So basically, when you know, you imagine going into combat, we'll talk about going into combat from in different scenarios, whether it be on a rugby field or a sports field in a minute. But you go into combat and, you know, it gets noisy. So you end up in a firefight. And everybody just thinks that they're the most important person on the battlefield straight away because, as you can imagine, you've got that chaos that we talked about that we hope that as leaders we can step back, making an assessment and then, you know, respond in the appropriate fashion. But you do get everybody on the radio immediately. And on a radio, you have a pressel switch and that basically opens the network for you. And I used to say, if it does go noisy, before you press the pressel switch, just ask yourself, does anybody really care about what I'm about to say? And it actually works because people will go, right, am I the most important person in this particular scenario? No, I'm not. And it'll obviously reduce to the numbers that are, and then you can have a clear line of conversation and those two people will be listening intently. Now, you've got to expect when people, whether it's a charity fundraiser and they've got an ex-SF bloke stood up in front of them or not, people want to enjoy themselves, they're relaxing, they're having a glass of wine. So that, you know, that emotional intelligence, you know, being able to respond in the correct fashion when somebody says, do I really need to bring my wetsuit booties? I shouldn't be responding in a way to go, are you stupid? Were you not listening?
I would just point out, you didn't say that, but you said that with your eyes.
But actually, it should have been a much softer response. And, you know, to cut it off, you get to the end of the story, really, just being able to respond in a calmer fashion and you just be a bit more, be softer with certain communities is something that's been a little bit of a challenge for me, yeah.
I love that. I know I'm really fascinated. I don't know if Lewis told you that the work that I do at Switch the Play, we do the same thing on transition. And what you just described then, minus the gunfire, is working with athletes and helping them understand what their transferable skills are. And I know I properly failed with my own emotional intelligence when I left that elite sporting world and took up my first proper job. Because I assumed I'd gone from an elite environment, which I'd only ever known from a young age, into a different environment. And I thought everyone was the same. I thought everyone was how I'd come through the ranks, if you like, and under that regime, that was the way to lead or be led, and everyone would fall in line. I learned very quickly that wasn't the case, and how you give your message across didn't always get received the same way. So were you aware of your emotional intelligence when you left or when you transitioned, or how is it? I found out quite in a hard way. How did you find out that it was something that you need to be more sensitive with?
Well, probably both. Probably the hard way as well, actually, from, because you learn by the responses that you get. So if you're not getting a positive response, I really don't care what anybody says. We like to be liked. Human beings like to, we work in groups. That's what, you know, our oldest instinct is, to operate in groups. And if you become isolated because of your behaviour or because you've decided to isolate yourself, it's unpleasant. I learned, the hard way that actually my behaviours weren't getting a positive reaction and I needed to mellow them. And I probably should have actually done that when I was in the military.
That was going to be my next question. That's my next question. Learning those whilst you're in action as opposed to reflecting on it.
I don't say I have any regrets, because, people have asked for my counsel about man management, because, apparently it was a pretty decent man management. And I enjoyed doing that stuff. I enjoyed leading blocks. And people have asked my counsel about what's important. I've always said that it's not, the most important thing isn't being popular. The blokes don't need another mate. They've got plenty of mates. But what they do need is to be 100% sure that you've got their best interests at heart. Now, as long as they've got that confidence, the niceties can actually just go off to a flank a little bit.
I think that's a challenge for a lot of people that are asked to take on a leadership role, isn't it? I know when I was asked to be captain, spent 10 years playing for England as just another one of the lads. You grow in terms of experience like you do with anything, and a leadership position you sort of fill naturally rather than being appointed into it because you've been there and done things. I found it really difficult when asked to be captain, actually, to then, just as Wayne said, realise that you can't suddenly be everyone's mate, because at times there are going to be decisions you have to make that will probably upset people, or if one of the lads doesn't get picked, I certainly wasn't picking the team, but you've got to try and support them. But also decisions that are coming your way on a pitch, you've got to be able to go, if you're the captain, yes, I've got to hear what that bloke's saying, but ultimately the decision's got to be mine. It was something I did find hard, actually, having to realise that, okay, I can't be everyone's mate now. I think across, I don't know, in your world now, Leon, in terms of that transition switch play, but your world as well, Rosie, maybe, maybe it's similar. Maybe people do struggle with that. And if you can't handle it, maybe it makes you a weaker leader. I'm not sure.
I don't know if it makes you a weaker leader. I think what's easier, I suppose, in sport and in the military, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you have a certain way of working and people in your environment know that you work that way. What is very different and I found challenging for me, and what ultimately made me go to university and do my degree in leadership, was reflecting that there are situational leadership. Different situations require different leadership styles. Whereas before, I only knew one, and that was the way that I'd been taught, and I knew it worked because we won lots of things and we were very successful. So in my mind, when things weren't working and people weren't trying to be the best and I couldn't get the team working together, I never thought it was because of me and my leadership style. I thought the issue had to be with them, because I knew that it worked. What I've since gone on to learn is
people learn in different ways.
Learn in different ways, and that is emotional intelligence. So I only got that from going away and studying and understanding, stick or carrot.
I love that, though. That just reflects maybe our different personalities. You thought that it was someone else's fault, whereas I would have been thinking, okay, that's my fault. Why aren't I delivering that correctly?
Yeah, but I'm never wrong.
And actually, neither of you are right and neither of you are wrong, because in all of those scenarios, it's a collective responsibility. So you talked about being appointed as captain. Sadly, I think that too many people think that they're only leaders when they're appointed as leaders, or when they're given stripes, or when they're put into a position, or they're given a particular appointment. I really don't agree with that. I think that, using the rugby scenario, the All Blacks week in, week out usually win. And pundits like yourselves will say, the All Blacks, they've got leaders all over the field. Now, they've only got one coach, they've only got one captain, but everybody is contributing in a positive way. Everybody's demonstrating leadership qualities. And that's the message that, if I can get a message across to anybody, or try to as often as I can, that everybody is a leader. We've all got influence on the others that are around us, on those people. That's emotional intelligence, And influence is, by pure definition, a leadership responsibility. Understanding that our actions will have an influence on somebody else is super important. That is leadership. And it should go right through the team or the organisation or the culture, like a name in a stick of rock.
I get asked a lot about the success that we had at Leicester and what was Martin Johnson like as a leader, you know, and I say the same thing all the time, and I don't think Jono would correct me, but Jono was our captain and he was an amazing captain. He was a leader of the team, but we had leaders within the team. Like you just said, we had different leaders. We had lots of different leaders. So he very rarely did the team talk. You know, he'd actually enabled other people to go and lead it whenever the time was right. So you'd have your scrum captain, your backs captain, your back three captain, your line-out captain, your scrum captain, all these different leaders. So yes, Jono was a person who flicked the coin, but across the whole squad, we had different leaders. If it was all left to one person, then I don't think we would have had that success. Whereas people on the outside may look and think it's all down to that one person, and, you know, it isn't. And I think you hit the nail on the head.
Definitely not. And the work is done before you get there. You know, before you walk down that tunnel or before you walk onto the battlefield, the work's already been done. It's been done in the weeks, months, years before that. They've got all the tools that they need to be successful. Allow them as individuals to employ them as part of the team, really.
We used to call that money in the bank, you know, so those training sessions that were absolutely minging and you hated, actually you enjoyed because you knew come a month prior to a World Cup, you know.
Train hard, fight easy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we probably stole that from you boys after the training camp in...
You
went in 99, we went in
03 and 07, I'm exactly sure you stole it from us, yeah.
Or you stole it from us, I'm not sure.
I thought I came up with it.
But I loved your point about leaders as well. And you know, when people are put into that leadership position, and I know this went through my mind when I was asked to be captain as well, is actually, okay, suddenly you've got to talk more, you've got to do things. Actually, you've been put in that position because you're leading anyway. So that's why you've been put in that position. So do you have to do anything differently than you are doing? And the best piece of advice anyone ever gave me was Jono. Just, I said, mate, you know, you've been a captain. You were this country's greatest ever, you know, leader from a rugby point of view. What advice would you give me? And he literally just said, be yourself. And that was it. And that was probably the most calming piece of advice I think I'd ever had. But anyway, not here to talk about me. Reflecting on wonderful memories.
It's not normal daily business today.
I can't help it. You know, I just love talking about myself all the time.
I've got an Oxford English Dictionary underneath my microphone here for those that are
listening. Just carry it around, don't you?
Just carry it around everywhere you go. I don't want to come across the big philosopher, but Aristotle did say that if you want to be happy, just be. You know, what? So that's your point. If you want to be happy... just be. I knew I should have been looking at
it.
Basically, we're saying...
Carry on. Me, it's like Ron Burgundy.
When I first joined, you know, when you're a young Marine and you're travelling around the world and you're getting drunk everywhere and you're having a really good crack, obviously you're super happy. And because you're happy in your work, you're probably going to be good at it. People notice that and they promote you. And on it goes. Well, to promote that guy because he's doing a really good job. I'm doing a really good job because I'm loving it. And then on it goes, it's perpetual. Now, actually, in my career, I got to a point, you know, when I was quite, because as you know, I commissioned from the ranks. I went through the ranks, commissioned from the ranks. But when I got to the ceiling of my non-commissioned ranks, I tried to get into positions that actually weren't fitting for me. I just thought it was the next rung on the ladder. It was what was expected of me. And I didn't really want to do it. And as a result, I wasn't particularly good at that particular, in that particular arena.
Do you reckon that's linked to your, you are obviously a high achiever. I've just got Lewis read through your CV. Do you think that's because you're high achievers that, you know, just never satisfied, always looking what's next? Well, I've got to hear what's next, rather than getting there and thinking, well, this is nice. I'm going to stay here for a little bit. So you're never satisfied, really?
Never. No, and I don't think that's a bad thing. No, I'm definitely never satisfied. And my point was that stick to something that you love and stay in that vein rather than just cutting yourself. I'm saying, right, that's the end of that. I need to go and do something different. Doesn't mean you have to stop achieving things. It just means it might be a slightly different route for you.
So one of the cool things about obviously having our own podcast, having this After the Whistle podcast, is that we can go in any direction we want. And one of the things that's been interesting me, and some people may be surprised by that, but is the growth of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, I read a great article in The Economist only yesterday about artificial intelligence, not just in sport, but in war and everything else that's going on around the world in globalization, how fast the world's moving with technology. It's useful to try and have your finger on the pulse.
Do you think artificial intelligence, I can't even get my, you know, AI. We go with AI for the simple rugby players out there. AI, do you think AI has a place in sport?
I think it does, yeah. I think I'm fascinated by all that type of thing. Even VR, virtual reality.
Thanks, mate. Yeah. That's good.
I'm a bit of a technophobe. That's why I read a lot about it, because I'm always conscious of it. I want to make sure that I've got my finger on the pulse of what's going on. But yeah, it does interest me. And where I tend to go for that information is The Economist.
The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. But don't just take our word for it. For your free print copy of The Economist, just text AFTER to 78070. That's text AFTER to 78070 for your free print copy. Let's get back to the interview. You talked in there about being a young Marine. I'm interested to know the route that you took, you know, so from Halifax, born in Halifax.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, family up there. What drove you or what pushed you into the Marines as a young man?
A number of things, really. My parents were amazing, really loving, but I don't have many fond memories of childhood. You know, it was really tough. You know, four kids, not a lot of work about, council house in West Yorkshire, all that sort of stuff. I wanted to get out of it. At the same time, actually, there was a programme on TV called Behind the Lines, which was about mountain leaders in the Royal Marines. And I remember all the kids of my age, all the lads of my age that were all out normally getting dirty and fighting or playing 25-a-side football. They were all saying, wow, you know, what must it be like to be a Royal Marine? That must be really tough. And that, to me, you know, saying something's really tough is like a red rag to a bull, really. So I thought, yeah, I'll have a bit of that. And then, you know, when your mates say, well, you've got no chance of doing that, that's another red rag. And went from there, really. And I really, I thrived in the challenge. I thrived in that environment. I thrived in the community. You know, I talked about the tribe, you know, the grouping. I really thrived in that. I really needed the community and still do. You know, the fundraising's great. Just as much, I enjoy being in the group. I enjoy being part of the group and having that unity towards a goal. That's what drives me. So joining the Royal Marines and you know, getting that fulfillment, if you like, was just the start. Right, what's next? Where can I be fulfilled? What's the next level of fulfillment? Well, it's really tough to get into the special forces. I'm having it, you know, and on it goes. Really.
Yeah.
You know, I'd love to go to the North Pole. Hardly anybody goes to the North Pole. I'm having it. Mm. You know, and on it goes, and on it goes, really.
I remember you said to me, you know, you talk about in sports, sometimes there's this fear of failure and people won't try things because they're scared of failing. I remember you said something to me once where I said, I never fail. And that wasn't from an arrogant point of view. You said it in the sense that because, you know, if I make a mistake or, you know, I get it wrong, I just go and try it again and do it in a different way and try and move forward. Do you think that's been applied to lots of aspects?
Yeah, definitely. And I didn't always have that view when I was immature or my emotional intelligence wasn't as developed as well as it is now. And there's still a lot of development to be done, Leon, don't get me wrong. We've used those two words a couple of times and, you know, without being disrespectful in any way, you know, failure and weakness, I don't like them. I took them out of my vocabulary. I use them every now and then, but I try to take them out of my vocabulary and I try and convince others to do so as well because there is too much fear of failure. You know, the F word is constantly used too much. You only fail if you give up or if you run out of time, you know, just keep plugging away at it. And weakness, there's no such thing as weakness. People aren't weak, but we do have limitations and vulnerabilities. We all have them. Some people have a lot more than others, don't get me wrong. But it doesn't mean you can't improve on them. You know, we talk about resilience. You're not either resilient or not. You're not weak or not. It goes up and down. It depends on the support that you're given from the people that are around you. So if you've got limitations and you've got vulnerabilities, that's why we work as teams, because our other teammates will hopefully help us overcome them limitations and vulnerabilities rather than just being told, you're weak. It seems so final. You've failed. It's final.
I want to know where, so you obviously joined the Marines. So it was 16?
17 and a half.
17 and a half. Where, so if you can reflect now, where do you think you would have been? What was going on in your life? And, you know, the background that it came from, where do you think you'd be now if you hadn't taken that path and making that choice?
Oh gosh, I wouldn't like to think. It probably would have been positive and that might sound slightly conceited, but I would have found something positive to aim for. Whether it was joining a police force, joining a fire brigade, I probably would have challenged myself to do something, you know, contributing to something valuable, super important to me. I think I probably would have still found a reasonable vocation because I would have challenged myself to be doing something that was contributing to something valuable.
What comes across for me, and I'm sure will for our listeners as well, that when you said it's like red rag to a bull, when someone says you can't do something, you'll go and do it. So the fact that was it the military that gave you that attitude, do you think? Or did you have that anyway to join the military? Because the reason I say that is because if it wasn't the military, then you'd have achieved something, you know, equally as great in a different sphere, just because you can tell by the way you're speaking how passionate you are about achieving things and striving and stretching yourself. Or do you think that you developed that from the military?
No, I think I already had it in me because obviously going and joining the Royal Marines was the first element, really. And I think absolutely the Royal Marines just enhanced that within me, really.
You introduced me to a book called Tribe once, actually, which was again about community. And you suddenly realise when you step out of, when you've been indoctrinated into something for so long, you know, 30 years in the Special Forces, and so longer with the Marines as well on top of that. You know, we had 16 years playing professional sport. You're in a, you're totally combined over that whole time. You know, you have so many experiences, personal experiences, you're intimately involved in each other's lives, and all of a sudden you step out of it and you feel you have to go and, I don't know, I certainly felt I had to go and try and achieve things on my own, which is, you know, probably quite naive, maybe didn't use the skill sets that I had. And it's an interesting road. And when you talk about it, just that book, and when I read it, it just reminded me actually how important community and working as a team is. And it fascinates me with your choice to then move into the Special Forces from the Marines is actually, how are the mindsets? You worked with us in 07 prior to the World Cup, we went on with Brian Ashton, we made a final. We're actually one of the crappiest England teams around at the time. We were playing awfully. But how similar do you think, from that time you spent with us, were the mindsets of elite sportsmen and elite soldiers? Is obviously the outcomes are vastly different. You know, we're not going to die when we go into our job on a rugby pitch.
People say to me, oh, you must be incredibly brave to have done what you've done. And I say, no, not at all. You know, you've got to be afraid to be brave. You know, you've got to be nervous to be courageous. And actually, when I was doing that stuff, and I know it's the case with, you know, 99.9% of the lads, that's when they're most comfortable. So it doesn't take bravery to do something that you're particularly comfortable at doing. You know, perhaps current, well, not so much here because I've got you guys and I'm not stood up on a big stage in front of hundreds of people. But sometimes, you know, I personally feel more vulnerable when I'm stood on a stage talking to 500 people about my experience and stuff. That's, you know, you got that sense of isolation and vulnerability there. That's when I'm nervous. You know, I was really comfortable when I was going onto a battlefield. But to go back to your point, yeah, the mindset is exactly the same, if not identical. It's about particular professionalisms. And we talked about earlier about coming from either the military, an institution, if you like, so yeah. Military, police, fire brigade, yeah. Very structured, yeah, thank you, into a civilian space. My early impressions was, you know, how unprofessional are these people? Why do people just knock off at R4 and go and not just stay for the extra 15 minutes to make sure that
the job
particular task has been achieved?
I share that frustration. I've had to mellow my style since, and I've been retired 11 years. And I still don't get it to this day, but I suppose you're a product of the environment. Having spent that much time in that environment yourself, it must be harder for you to actually accept that people clock in at 9, finish at 5.
Yeah.
Mid-email. Yeah. Just going, I'll finish it tomorrow. I've never been able to get it. Hopefully, I'll never be able to accept it either, because that's not the way I am. But how have you found that?
I found that really difficult. Just, I think it's, in a way, it's positively rude the way that some people behave, you know, like, send an email and they just don't reply because they're not interested. At least say, actually, I'm not interested, thank you very much. But you get that, because you've got those structures in sport. And if you don't do as you're told, then you're not going to get selected. You know, there are certain ways that we behave in this organisation or you're not going to get selected. Right, fine, my goal is to get promoted or my goal is to, you know, rescue that hostage. There is a certain way of doing things. My goal is to win the World Cup, which I can't believe you haven't mentioned 3 or 4 times yet.
Later, mate,
so you, later. So you know, we're professional. We plan, we prepare, and we go towards a goal.
I wanted to touch on something else. I mean, we spoke about the similarities between the mindset. One thing that's very different is the outcome. I mean, often people talk about when you retire from sport, or certainly sport anyway, in particular. And this was voiced to me, was you got to treat it as a grieving process, and that's fine. It's all well and good. I understand that, and I think I probably did try to do that, but that's very different than actually, you know, us going out on a field and one of us getting injured and going off, or me retiring, to actually genuinely having to grieve because you've lost a comrade or a mate. How tough is that?
Well, it's, you know, it's tough. Whenever you go into a military operation, I'm going to use a little bit of doctrine for you now.
Yeah.
When we go through the estimate process and we give a set of orders, we talk about what's called the main effort.
Mm.
And the main effort might be to rescue the hostage, or in old-fashioned terms, take that hill or take that machine gun post. And my personal main effort as a leader, you know, as a sergeant major and all that stuff, going on the ground, was to make sure that everybody that goes on the ground comes off safe. That was my priority, my number one priority, not rescuing the hostage or taking a hill. If I could get everybody back, at least we could have another go, you know. Don't get me wrong. We would take more risks in certain scenarios. A hostage rescue is an example. You would take a lot more risks because, you know, there's a person at the other end. Life depends on it. You know, don't get me wrong, I people did get injured, and sadly we did lose people when I was on the ground. And it's upsetting, but it never really had any lasting effect on me. And it never had any lasting effect on me because I knew I'd always done my utmost to make sure it was, you know, things were done proper. I'd always given 100%. I always knew that we'd mitigated risk as much as we possibly could. I always knew that everybody was on the ground and me was doing exactly the same and had exactly the same attitude. So it never lasted me. People die in conflict. People die on battlefields. But I'm pretty confident that none died on a battlefield because I didn't give my best effort. So it never stayed with me in a grieving type fashion. Not with any longevity, if you like. Actually, the worst scenario for me, or the worst incident for me, was I promoted, ironically, and I came back to the UK to go into another position, and somebody stepped into my place, as happens, you know, in the military, that's what happens. And within weeks, a couple of lads had life-changing injuries, and that did hit me hard. And because my instant thoughts were, you know, if I'd have been there, would I have done something different? You know, would that have happened if I'd been, you know, ridiculous thoughts, really. So not being there was the most difficult. Not being there when something happened is probably was the most difficult time for me, really, with those two guys.
That's almost a loss of control as well. You know, you were
absolutely
unable to control the situation.
Absolutely. And I had that conversation with, and I know you guys probably get it all the time. One of the first questions you'll get is, do you miss playing? And I've been very fortunate to go to a couple of dinners with Sam Warburton, who I'm a huge admirer of. And the first question he always gets asked, do you miss playing? And he just says no straight away. And that's because he's got absolutely no regrets. Regrets are really bad.
Do you think that, or do you think he's just lying? Because I remember, and I'm not going to, you know, obviously that's his opinion, and it might be absolutely true, but I miss playing all the time. I honestly loved it that much. So but not just the playing, I love the training. And maybe it's just that. Maybe actually what I miss is the community. What we talked about is actually a sense of shared goals. But because you can't be as physical as we were on the pitch and give as much as we did to each other and a collective cause, you know, which was for us winning the Premiership or whatever title it was that year, or the game at the weekend, and give up so much of your body in terms of injuries and everything to then just step away from it and not miss it. Well, I can't anyway. And I look back and I sometimes think when people say that, and it's no discredit to Sam because it was a huge amount of time, fantastic player, but I miss it. I miss it all the time. And I think doing the challenges that we do actually is almost trying to replace that in some ways.
I'm the opposite to you.
Okay.
I definitely don't miss it.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
My body's sore.
Okay. That's fair enough.
No, genuinely, but what you've touched on a really good point is you're trying to chase, and I'm the same, I'm trying to chase that same feeling that I had that is linked to that team, that camaraderie. So I miss the 1 minute before we went out onto the pitch. Before we even played the game, the 1 minute where we look around, it's just you and the guys, nobody else. You run out and then whatever happened on the pitch, thankfully we won more than we lost. But I don't miss that. But then I also miss when the final whistle's gone and you look around and you see everybody else and everyone's battered and bruised and you look around and you look at each other and you go, right, same again next week. I miss that. I do not miss those 80 minutes. But I do miss, and I remember I said to Jono when Jono was the manager of England and I was going through a tough time with my own transition. I was saying, please tell me that managing England is this, because I couldn't find anything that replicated that same feeling, the adrenaline, that on a week in, week out basis. I said, please tell me that when you manage England at a weekend at Twickenham, you get that same buzz that you had as a player, because I need to believe that I can feel that same feeling again. And he just literally knocked me for six. He went, no, I can't, because I'll be lying. We were very lucky to experience that. He said, managing England is a great experience, but it's not the same as what we had as players. He said, you've got to move on, find other ways to fill that void, but that's not it. And it's sort of, and I'm one of those believers, I say he was a great captain. If Jono says it, it's true. So I sort of left that, I left him feeling pretty deflated. But I totally get what you mean about, you know, you've a lot more physical and you're in that, you probably miss that physicality. I don't know.
And we all miss different things, I suppose, don't we? I'm sure you do, Wayne.
Yeah.
And it's all personal, isn't it?
Perhaps you just, perhaps you miss rugby more than you miss playing. I believed Sam when he said, I don't miss playing. I think if you tore him out and made him become a bank clerk, he would miss rugby terribly.
Mm.
But he's still in the thick of it. He's still in the thick of it, and whether it's punditing or just...
Yeah. He's not trying to also, he's only just finished. He's still not... He's just taken 2 years. He's taken 2 years before he actually realised.
He's on holiday.
There's quite a common saying in the military, you know, especially when you get to my age. Well, not to my age, because not very few people in the military get to my age, do they, Lou?
No. 75 is a rare age.
But you know, you've got to be careful what you wish for as well.
Yeah.
So going back to your little story there, when a CH-47, the helicopter, the blades are spinning and you're coming down into the desert and you know the target's immediately beyond you, you know, there's bullets whizzing around everywhere and the tailgate opens and you run out. I will never forget that.
How do you replicate that?
You can't. It's impossible. It is impossible. Now, beyond that, once it starts, it's almost like you switch into a different mode and what happens, really. But that moment in, you know, that transition from relative safety of the aircraft to being on the battlefield, you'll never fill that buzz. And you get exactly the same where you're walking down a tunnel and you can hear the scream getting louder and louder and louder and louder, and then you run on a pitch. And then what happens. It's exactly the same scenario, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Now, I'll never be able to fulfill that, and I've accepted it.
Do people struggle with that, though? Because I think that certainly in sport, and I've done a little bit of work with the military, that's the bit that people struggle to accept. That's not there, that's not going to happen again.
They do struggle, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the only evidence is there that people do struggle with it, especially if they haven't been able to have a full career. I mean, it's probably better for you, certainly for you, Lynx. I know your career was ended prematurely, wasn't it, you know, through injury. So that would be infuriating. For me, you know, I've lived to a ripe old age and done it for a pretty long career. So yeah. Great, I've done it. It's
more content.
Yeah, absolutely content.
That's a really good point, because me and Leon have spoken about this numerous times, and I had the great pleasure of, obviously, I don't know if you know this, but playing in the World Cup team in 2003.
Yeah, yeah. How'd you get on?
It went all right. But Leon was of my age. We all played in the same side. And I think you have said to me that because you weren't part of that World Cup side, but you were close, you did the World Cup in 99, you were in the build up to 03, you are almost chasing your World Cup moment still, which is why you work so hard, why you're doing such an incredible job, you know, CEO of Switch the Play, CEO of various other companies to get to this point. And I think you both sort of hit the nail on the head. That's an interesting point.
It's good. I think we've all got a World Cup in us, be that on the pitch or in the military or anything. We've all got that thing that we're striving for. Like you just said, I can't achieve mine on the pitch, so I have to change and try and figure out what that is in a different way. And I'm still the same person, still got the same mindset, and as we all have. It's about sometimes, I think, stopping and reflecting on what you've done, and I sort of alluded to it earlier on, rather than just keep going and always being not satisfied because you're always striving. But there are more people in the world that haven't won a World Cup or are not going to win a World Cup than they have won a World Cup. So there's that bit as well, there's that being honest with yourself, I think. But it's tough for not just me, it's for lots of people who transition.
I'm just because we could chat for, literally I could chat for hours to both of you and to Rosie in particular. But
thanks very much.
I speak to you way too often, mate. I fall asleep half the time. I need you at bedtime for story time. I'd be fine. I'd be sleeping left, right, centre. But mate, one of the questions I really wanted to ask you, obviously the whole media age now, we've got all the, you know, smartphones, we've got cameras everywhere. Your identity, your obscurity as Special Forces is, you know, is renowned the world over. So two questions: how important was that for you as an individual, and how much has the media world now and the guys that come out and write books and the TV shows, which you've got the Who Dares Wins program that's out now, how has that changed things, and how do you feel about all that?
Yeah, it's a huge change. Funnily enough, I was I was chatting to a visitor, an organization, yesterday. Who finds the media particularly, what's the word I'm looking
engaging,
for once again?
Enjoying?
No, exactly the opposite.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
intrusive.
Particularly intrusive, yeah. It despises the media. Let me just be absolutely blunt about it.
Yeah.
And I was telling him a story about my first real interaction with media was the night of the invasion for the second Gulf War. Somebody decided in their wisdom that they would allow a big press grouping to be infilled in the second wave. So the first wave was us, and, you know, the battle ensued, if you like. And in the second wave onto Alfour Peninsula, there was a whole helicopter just full of media and press. Now, one end of the peninsula, some hours later, in fact, as we were getting towards dawn, there'd been some casualties, a couple of Iraqi casualties, and we were up there. So, you know, we picked these Iraqi casualties up to take them down to the first aid post to get them some care. And I remember being on a quad with another guy, and with a trailer on the back, and we've got this guy on the back looking after these guys and holding them onto the trailer as we headed towards the first aid post to get them some care. And the media spotted us as we were going down. They were in this little hut on the side of a little road that went right up the middle of this oil refinery on the peninsula. And they jumped in front to stop the quad. so they could take pictures of these injured guys on the back on the trailer. And I remember thinking, you know, what, you know, what kind of an individual do you have to be to do that? You know, so my kind of, my impression, if you like, of the media from that point forward was more of a negative one than a positive one. I don't think that media representation of UKSF is helpful in any way, none whatsoever, and that's why I wouldn't comment on it, and UKSF definitely will never comment on it, and they don't comment on it. There'll be people out there saying you're a bit of an hypocrite. You're on, you know, you're on the wireless, given doing a podcast. But you know,
that's a radio for anyone that's you know.
I'm very careful about what I say, because I absolutely wouldn't want to compromise all those tactics, techniques, and procedures that keep my mates safe, you know, and keep you safe. Frankly, keep me safe. So I'm very sensitive about it. So you know, the little pieces that people put in the media, or the big pieces that are put into media in the form of books and stuff, they can be really damaging, because people are putting that jigsaw together to use against us. Our adversaries are using those against us. So I don't like it. Social media is with us. And I've said recently, when it came to like the recruiting space, you know, it's difficult to recruit into special forces, because, you know, not a lot of people have got what it takes to get in there. You know, we struggle for numbers. And so using social media, I've been an advocate of using social media to recruit people, to help people to be prepared to come in, because you have to use those mediums, because that's how people communicate now. It's pointless pushing against it. But we have to be really sensitive about how there's some very positives, but I think there are some negatives, you know, it can be harmful.
I just want to ask a question linked to that about social media and technology and everything else. The world's changing so quickly and technology is improving rapidly. So that just means that warfare and how we fight people and everything else is going to change as well. How do you see the world and wars, if you like, being in 10 years' time? It's going to be very different to how it's been 10 years ago in 10 years' time, and the way things are moving quickly. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. It's a difficult one to answer, really, because you know, you're absolutely right. Innovation and technology is really important. The battlefields are shifting to cyberspace and stuff. You know, electronic warfare is key. Lots of our adversaries are still going to come from, you know, less developed worlds. You know, so, you know, whether it be in East Africa or North Africa or, you know, other areas of the Middle East, they probably don't have quite as much tech. Certainly the Taliban is an example. You know, they're just age-old, tough people, and they'll fight any which way they can, really. So that kind of, the guerrilla warfare, you can only really combat in one way, and that's with the man on the ground, to be perfectly honest. I seem to remember somebody gave me a statistic at Tora Bora trying to find OBL in the early days. They dropped about 10,000 tons in the, you know, first day or something of ordnance, and all they did was break rocks. You know, you need a man on the ground.
Fair enough. I think we've spoken, Fraser, mate. Last point, and short and succinct, is best piece of advice you've ever been given that you could share with us.
Well, let's make it slightly amusing, shall we? Let's end off on a little bit of humour.
Well, this would be very unusual for you, actually.
I went on a what's called a forward air controllers course up in RAF Leeming, and the guy who's, what you get as part of that is a flight in essence a Red Arrow, a Hawk jet, and it's just really to give you an understanding of the difficulties the pilot's going through, how quick things are happening, so that you can respect his position when you're on the ground talking to him. So you get all the preparation, the G-pants and all that sort of stuff. And this old boy who had flown Jaguars in the Falklands still had his leather Biggles jacket and all that sort of stuff, slicked back, brill cream, grey hair, suave. He walked up to me and he said, all right, nice to meet you. You're flying with me today? Yeah, I am, yeah. He said, well, once we're up there, if I say eject, 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 and I leave the aircraft, just carry out the drills that you've been taught by the ground crew. Yes, sir, absolutely. He said, if I leave the aircraft without saying eject, 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 I suggest you do the same.
Brilliant.
So I thought, right, okay, fair enough.
Rosie, Wayne, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for your honesty, your stories, your experiences. So that's a perfect point to call an end to this. Thank you for listening. If you liked what you heard, please rate, review, subscribe, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leon, anything from you?
Just a thanks again, really. We appreciate your support. And we desperately, as we mentioned in previous episodes, we crave your feedback. So please leave us your feedback, which bits you like, which bits you didn't like. You can't see what Lewis is wearing, but you can take it from me. That's something that I don't like. But please leave your feedback. Thank you.
Well, at least I'm not wearing it. You know, you're in a suit. You're not even going to a business meeting today. We're in a, you know, we're in a studio. Why do you need the suit? There's some more feedback.
Thank you.